Protecting the nuns like that. You call yourself a journalist, but you're just a liar. You left everything important out. My quiet, normal life. Are you blind? She hears him sighing on the other end, but she goes on. You made it sound like I had an enchanted childhood in that place, for Christ's sake. Why didn't you just tell the truth? It would have made for a much better story. Nancy is watching her with her big eyes.
Do you read the classifieds?
He interrupts, silencing her rant.
No. Maybe you should.
I won't ever read your paper again, asshole.
You don't write the truth. I really think you'll need to buy today's paper.
Why?
A copy editor I know in the classifieds department mentions as someone who's been running an ad for years, the first Saturday of every month. I think it could be you he's looking for.
Me? What are you talking about?
Your story matches the details in this classified ad. I'll just go buy the goddamn paper.
He hangs up. In spite of her vow never to read a newspaper again, she drags Nancy to the corner store to pick up the Journal de Montréal. She scans the entire classified section right there, until she comes to the ad that just about stops her heart. I am in search of a young woman with the given name Elodie, born March 6, 1950, at the Brome-Missisquoi Perkins Hospital in the Eastern Townships. She was transferred in 1957 from the Saint-Sulpice Orphanage near Farnham to Saint-Nazarius Hospital in Montreal. I have information about her birth family. Please call. And just like that, everything changes. Her birth family. She repeats those words over and over in her head as she rushes home, clutching the newspaper to her heart.
What's wrong, maman?
Nancy asks, trying to keep pace with Elodie.
Nothing's wrong,
Elodie says, crouching down to her daughter's eye level. It's just the opposite. I think everything might finally be all right. Chapter 53 Maggie. It's the usual Sunday evening chaos. Gabrielle is over at the farm, and Maggie is by herself with the kids. The phone is ringing, and Stephanie's having a tantrum because she wants to wear her rain boots in the bath. James is at the kitchen table watching an Expos game and eating his third supper of the night. He's a bottomless pit these days. The TV is blaring. Maggie grabs the phone, ignoring Stephanie, who's pulling on her bell-bottoms and wailing about needing to wear the boots in the bathtub so she can pretend it's a puddle.
Allô?
Maggie answers.
I saw your ad in the Journal de Montréal today, a woman says.
I'm sorry, what ad?
It said you have information about my birth family. My name is Elodie.
Maggie's knees buckle. She reaches her arm out to the counter to hold herself up.
Madame?
Elodie says.
Yes, I'm here, sorry. The ad said to call this number.
Of course, Maggie manages, reeling. Gabrielle must have placed it. All this time he's let her do the crusading, but quietly he's been looking for Elodie too.
So this is the right number, the woman says.
Yes, Maggie manages.
Yes.
She's not dead. It's her. When she read the article in the paper last week about Monique and the Duplessis orphans, she felt a resurgence of hope. She thought there was a strong possibility that Monique could be Elodie. The problem was Maggie still didn't know how to find her. She suggested to Gabrielle that they drive around Pointe Saint-Charles, patrolling up and down the streets in search of a 24-year-old woman they might hopefully recognize. But Gabrielle put his foot down, told her she was being irrational and manic. They did visit every sewing factory in the Pointe, Saint-Henri, and Griffintown, but no one fitting Elodie's description worked at any of them. Maggie even went to the Centre de Retrouvailles, but all she could do was leave her own information and hope that Elodie would show up there one day looking for her birth mother.
The ad says you have information about my birth family?
Yes, I do, Maggie stammers, trying to sound normal. Stephanie is still tugging on Maggie's bell-bottoms, whining about the goddamn rubber boots. Maggie holds the phone away from her mouth and says to James, "Get her out of here." James ignores her. "Do it now," Maggie hisses. "Put her in a bath."
"With my boots on?"
Stephanie wants to know.
"Yes,"
Maggie says impatiently. Stephanie immediately perks up and skips off. James turns off the TV and follows her begrudgingly out of the kitchen, leaving Maggie alone. "Do you know anything about your background?" she asks Elodie.
hoping to establish it's really her. I was born in 1950, Elodie says. I don't know the date. Nobody adopted me because I was small and sickly. I don't know much else. My mother died giving birth to me. Maggie clamps a hand over her mouth to keep from crying out. Died giving birth. Why the hell would the nuns tell her that? Who am I? Elodie asks her again. What is my family name? Your name is Elodie Phoenix, Maggie says, trying to steady her breathing and stay calm. And who are you? Maggie hesitates, not sure how to respond. The poor girl thinks her mother is dead. How can Maggie tell her the truth over the phone? I'm Maggie, she says at last. I think I might be your aunt. My mother's sister? Yes, Maggie lies. She had a daughter born March 6, 1950, a few weeks early. The baby was at Saint-Sulpice until 1957, and then transferred to Saint-Nazarius. My sister gave her the name Elodie. Before she died? Maggie squeezes her eyes closed. Yes, before she died. It was on the birth certificate. I have so many questions. Me too, Maggie thinks. I want to know all about her, Elodie says. And do I have other relatives? What about my father? Would you like to meet in person? Yes, Elodie says, and Maggie surges with excitement. They arranged to meet next weekend. Maggie was hoping for sooner. She'd drive to her apartment now if she could. But she senses that Elodie is more apprehensive about how quickly everything is happening, and she backs off. She tries reaching Gabriel at Clementine's, but he's already left and is on his way home. Maggie doesn't mention anything about her conversation with Elodie. Gabrielle has to be the first to know. Maggie paces around the kitchen, desperate to get her hands on that newspaper. She needs Gabrielle to walk through that door. Still shaking, she sits down at the table, her head pounding with a burgeoning migraine. My daughter is alive. She never really believed Elodie was dead, but it still makes no sense that Sister Ignatia would have lied to her that day in 1961. Who would deliberately keep a mother from her own child? The inhumanity of it, the sheer cruelty, is something Maggie will never be able to comprehend or forgive. She robbed Maggie of 13 years with her daughter. The back door slams open and Maggie jumps up, flinging her body into Gabrielle's arms.
Now what's going on? He asks. Kids asleep?
The kids? She completely forgot about them. They're being quiet upstairs, probably thrilled she's forgotten about them and they're getting to stay up late. I don't know.
You don't know where the kids are, he says,
placing a bucket of blueberries on the counter. Elodie called. Gabrielle stops and turns to face her.
Eh?
Elodie called here, she repeats. She's alive. The color drains from his face. She read your ad and she called, Maggie cries. How long have you been running it? It means that nun did lie to us, which I always knew. Do you remember her telling us how sick Elodie was when she was transferred to the hospital?
Wait, what ad?
In the classifieds. The Journal de Montréal. Gabriel shakes his head, his expression blank.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
They stand there for a moment, staring at each other.
Go to the store, Maggie says. Go get the paper.
What about Elodie? What did she say? How did she sound?
It was a very short conversation, she says, and gives him a quick summary. Brushing tears from his eyes, Gabrielle disappears out the back door. The store is just at the corner of their street, so it doesn't take long. Maggie stands by the door until he returns, and hands it to her. Silently, frantically, they tear through the paper to the back pages.
There,
Gabrielle says, pointing to it. I am in search of a young woman with the given name Elodie, born March 6, 1950. At the Brome Missisquoi Perkins Hospital in the Eastern Townships. She was transferred in 1957 from the Saint-Sulpice Orphanage near Farnham to Saint-Nazarius Hospital in Montreal. I have information about her birth family. Please call. They stare at the ad, more baffled than before.
That's our number.
We have to call the paper, she says. Find out who placed this ad. Someone who knows our number.
It's Saturday night. We won't reach anyone until Monday.
Could it be Clementine?
She wouldn't interfere, he says. Not with something like this.
My mother?
Gabrielle rolls his eyes. No one knows about Elodie other than my mother, she says. The only people who knew are dead. Who else could it be?
Gabrielle quickly pulls a cigarette from his pack and lights up.
What if this is all a hoax?
It's our number in the paper.
How do you even know it was really her on the phone? What if it wasn't?
Who else would it be? Maggie says. Another orphan named Elodie? She knew things.
What if it's another girl from the hospital? Someone who knows the facts about Elodie's life and is looking for a handout. We have to be careful here, Maggie. No matter how much we want it to be her, none of this makes sense.
She has nothing to gain by pretending to be our daughter.
Of course she does. A family, possible financial support. Any girl could say her name is Elodie.
Since when are you so cynical? Maggie accuses. Why can't you just let this be the miracle that it is?
God damn it, Maggie, he cries,
banging his fist on the table.
I'm scared to let myself believe it might be her. This isn't only about you. As far as I'm concerned, she's mine.
I'm sorry.
He sits down and runs a hand through his hair.
We're going to have to wait until Monday.
She thinks I'm dead, Maggie tells him. They told her I died in childbirth. It's probably in her bullshit file.
But why?
God only knows. I went along with it over the phone, she confesses. I didn't know what else to do. I said I was her aunt.
Calice.
I should call her back and tell her I'm alive. I shouldn't have lied.
You can't tell her over the phone, he says. You gave her away, Maggie. It's going to be a big enough shock for her to find out you're alive. Never mind that you gave her up.
You're right, she says, defeated. She's going to hate me.
If it's her, she's going to need time.
It is her, Maggie says, sounding a bit like Stephanie when she's not getting her way. Think about this, Gabrielle. That day we went to Saint-Nazarius and asked about Elodie, she was there. We were probably just a few feet away from her on the other side of those doors.
And what did the nuns do?
They told us she was dead, and they let her go on believing I was dead.
Gabrielle stands up again and circles the kitchen table. She watches him scan the room, knowing he's looking for something to punch or throw, a way to vent his anger. His eyes light on the vase of Stephanie's wildflowers, but he manages to restrain himself. Maggie gets up and goes over to him, touches his cheek, which is wet.
Do you really think it's her? He says softly.
We're going to meet her, she tells him. And then we'll know for sure. We have to focus on that right now, and we have to find out who placed this ad.
Call your mother.
Maggie goes to the phone. While she's dialing, Gabrielle says,
I'm going to fucking murder that nun. All of them who did this to us. If it is Elodie and they told us she was dead, it's sick. And why? So they could keep her locked up in that fucking mental institution rather than give her back to us? Why the hell would they do that?
I don't know, Maggie says, trying to stay grounded for both of them. I don't understand either, but listen to me. Listen. We're going to have her in our lives after all. That's what matters now.
Her mother answers after about a dozen rings.
Ma, Maggie cries. Are you the one who placed the ad?
I'm watching La Petite Patrie. Did you place the ad in the classified section of the Journal de Montréal?
Maggie repeats.
What ad? Her mother says. What are you talking about? My show is about to end.
You didn't place an ad looking for Elodie?
Bien non, she says. Why would I do that?
I don't know. I just thought, doesn't matter. Go finish your show.
Maggie hangs up, disappointed. It wasn't her, she says, joining Gabrielle at the table.
Of course it wasn't her.
Who then?
Gabrielle shrugs.
I don't think I can wait until Monday.
I wonder if she's mine,
Gabrielle says, exhaling a ring of smoke.
We'll know right away, don't you think?
Probably.
24 years.
She suffered, Maggie says, her voice breaking. If she grew up in that awful place...
It didn't sound so bad in the article.
Maybe it didn't tell the whole story, Maggie points out. You know how the French papers like to protect the church. Remember that book I read a few years ago? The Mad Cry for Help? That sure painted a different picture.
No sense torturing yourself, Gabrielle tells her. You'll be able to ask her yourself soon.
That's what I'm afraid of, Maggie says, reaching for the cigarette he's left burning in the ashtray. Chapter 54. First thing Monday morning, Gabriel calls the newspaper. Maggie hovers behind him.
Make sure you get a name, she insists. They may not want to say.
I haven't even been transferred to classifieds yet.
Ask if it was a man or a woman, she says. And how long has the ad been running? And how often?
Bonjour, madame,
he says, gesturing to Maggie to stop talking. Maggie steps away to give him some space. She chews on a nail, kills a fly buzzing around the windowsill, opens the back door to toss it outside. It's a beautiful morning, the sun already blinding, the air thick and perfumed by her garden. She examines her hollyhocks, which are in full bloom, forming the towering wall of pink, coral, and white flowers she'd envisioned 2 years ago when she planted them. She goes back inside and is disappointed to see that Gabrielle is still on the phone.
Who placed the ad? She mouths.
Gabrielle glares at her and puts a finger to his mouth.
Don't forget to ask if it's going to run again, she says.
And is it scheduled to run again?
He asks, motioning for Maggie to hand him his coffee.
I see, he says. Please go ahead and cancel it. No need to run it anymore.
After a beat.
Yes, she did.
Maggie signals maniacally for Gabrielle to wrap up.
Thank you, he says. You have been very helpful.
As he puts down the phone, Maggie throws up her hands in exasperation.
So?
She cries. I'm surprised you didn't invite her over for dinner.
The ad was paid for by Mr. Peter Hughes.
Peter? She shakes her head. My brother? That doesn't make sense.
Call him.
Gabrielle hands Maggie the phone, and she dials his number at work.
Peter Hughes, he answers, in what Maggie perceives as a rather self-important tone.
He recently made partner at a large architecture firm in Toronto, as per the photocopied letter he mailed everyone in the family at Christmas.
Elodie called me, she blurts.
No preamble, no greeting. Peter is quiet.
Did you hear me?
Yes, he says. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Yes, she says. But why? I'm stunned, Peter.
Peter laughs good-naturedly.
Really? She says. Why? And why not tell me?
It wasn't me, Maggie. It was Daddy.
It takes a moment for his words to land.
He started running the ad years ago, Peter explains. Before he got sick. The first Saturday of every month.
He never said.
He made me promise to keep doing it after he died. And not to tell you.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe she actually saw it and called you, he says. After all these years. I never thought she would. I told Daddy I thought it was futile. But he could be stubborn, as you know.
Does Ma know?
Are you kidding? Of course not.
Maggie leans over the sink and turns on the tap, splashes water on her face. It's hot in the kitchen. She tucks the phone between her ear and shoulder and opens the window for some air.
Will you meet her?
Peter asks her.
Yes,
Maggie says.
Next week?
The week crawls by. Maggie and Gabrielle go through the motions of each day, feigning normalcy for the kids. They don't discuss Elodie much among themselves, preferring instead to process it alone. Maggie can think of little else, but with two children, life keeps moving forward whether she likes it or not. There are meals to prepare, moods to manage, tantrums to quell, fights to break up, baths, house cleaning. At work, it's catalog season, on top of which her publisher just sent her a book to consider for translation. It doesn't end, and certainly doesn't leave much time for anguishing over her fears. Still, the knot in her chest doesn't go away, not for a minute. Beneath every word or movement courses an unrelenting strum of anxiety. Her thoughts stubbornly drift back to Elodie. What will she say to her when they finally meet? She keeps imagining that moment over and over in her mind, the way Elodie will react, the possibility of her anger and hatred, the withholding of forgiveness. Maggie can't bear the thought. The dread in her body is visceral, as if Elodie were already standing in front of her, accusing and rejecting her. When Maggie's mother gets wind of the reunion, she calls Maggie in a panic.
Some things are better left alone, she cries.
She's my daughter, Ma,
This isn't even a conversation.
This is not a good idea, Maggie. You gave her up.
It's the 70s, Ma. No one gives a shit that I had a baby at 16.
You can't tell the kids. What will they think of you?
They'll understand. I told you, times are different now. They don't judge like your generation did.
What will she think of you? Maman says. What if she hates you? Have you thought about that?
It's all I've thought about, Maggie says, and hangs up. The night before she's to meet Elodie, Maggie wakes up with a racing heart. She snuggles against Gabrielle. To calm herself, she tries to remember the stories her father used to tell her to help her fall asleep. One of his favorite aphorisms comes into her mind, and she can almost hear his voice, as if he's speaking to her now.
He who plants a seed plants life.
At least she did that. She gave Elodie life, though not much else. Chapter 55. Maggie pulls her cake out of the oven and sets it down on the counter to cool. The house is quiet. The kids are at her mother's for the afternoon. It was easier than trying to explain everything. Gabrielle is out in the yard, building a treehouse for the kids, trying to keep his mind off everything. She watches him from her kitchen window, hammering and sawing, his Canadien cap pulled down over his brow. She loves him as much as she did when she used to watch him working in his cornfield.
Your cake sank, Clementine says.
She's here for moral support. Maggie looks over at the sad cake and her heart sinks with it.
You're a terrible baker, Maggie.
It's this oven, Maggie defends, and they both laugh. The cake goes in the garbage.
I brought crackers and cheese, Clementine says.
And cookies. Cookies from a package? Clementine rolls her eyes. My mother would never serve packaged cookies to a guest, Maggie mutters, and then regrets it immediately. Clementine's face falls and she quickly turns away. Sometimes Maggie forgets. She's become so close to her sister-in-law over the years. She can hardly remember that Clementine was her father's lover first, her mother's nemesis. I'm sorry, Maggie says, grabbing Clementine's hand. I didn't mean it like that.
Course not, Clementine says, tossing cheese on a platter. Will red rose tea be good enough? Or would your mother have brought the leaves in from China?
Maggie bursts into laughter and Clementine joins in, the awkwardness quickly dispelled. And then a knock at the door. They look at each other. Neither of them moves until Clementine says,
Let's go meet your daughter.
Maggie is frozen. Clementine squeezes her hand, and they go to the front door in silence. She's a few feet away, Maggie tells herself, trying to convince herself this is really happening. She's on the other side of that door. The moment has a surreal quality to it, as though it's just another one of her silly fantasies. It feels as if Clementine is opening the door in slow motion. And then she's there. Maggie hears herself gasp. It's her. Her face has an unmistakable stamp of Hughes and Phoenix. Allô, Elodie says. She attempts a smile, but doesn't meet Maggie's eyes.
Come in, Clementine says, stepping aside.
Elodie enters the house. Maggie wipes her eyes, not wanting to frighten the girl with an emotional outburst before she's even through the door. She has to keep reminding herself that Elodie has no idea who she is.
I'm Maggie, she says, her voice sounding strange. And this is my friend Clementine.
Elodie says hello, again without making eye contact with either of them. She has a nervous, skittish energy, but who could blame her? Clementine takes Elodie's macrame poncho and shows her to the living room. Maggie notices she walks with a slight limp. She's wearing jeans and an olive green tank top. She's very thin. But it's her face Maggie can't stop staring at, even though it's mostly hidden behind a curtain of long hair, parted in the middle. There's an undeniable resemblance to Maggie's side of the family, certain subtle traces of her sister's, the curve of Jerry's mouth, the wide space between Vi's eyes, the thick Hughes eyebrows they all share. She's fair and dirty blonde, and her body, lanky and long-limbed, is pure Phoenix.
Would you like a cup of tea? Maggie asks her as she gestures to the couch. Or a Pepsi?
Pepsi, please,
Elodie says, sitting down. Yes, of course, Maggie says. I'll be right back. She goes to the kitchen and splashes water on her face. She's trying hard not to hyperventilate. She throws open the back door and calls out to Gabriel. He stops hammering and turns to her, his face ghost white. He approaches slowly. It's her, Maggie says before he can even ask. See for yourself. Gabriel takes a long breath, bracing himself, and they go inside together. This is my husband, Gabriel, Maggie says, returning to the living room and handing Elodie a glass of soda. Gabriel, this is Elodie. Tears come to Gabrielle's eyes the moment he sees her. He knows he's her father, Maggie can tell. She sees it registering in his eyes. He pulls her brusquely into his arms and squeezes. He never was one to hold back. Let her breathe, Maggie says softly. Gabrielle releases the girl and stands back, gawking at her. None of them can stop staring at her. Maggie can't quite believe this is the infant she first laid eyes on in an enamel basin more than 2 decades ago. And in some ways she isn't. She looks a little malnourished, like she doesn't eat well. She doesn't have good teeth or skin, a sign of poverty. There's a scar over her eye. I can't believe I'm here, Elodie says, echoing Maggie's thoughts. That you're my aunt. The ad's been running for years, Maggie says. How did you finally come across it? A shadow passes over her eyes. There was an article about me in the journal a couple of weeks ago, she explains. The journalist who wrote it recognized my story in your ad. He told me to buy the paper and read the classifieds. A miracle, Clementine whispers. We read that article, Maggie says. I thought there were a lot of similarities. It was all lies, Elodie states, her tone turning harsh. He left everything important out, like all the facts. He made it sound like a fairy tale, which it wasn't. I don't exactly lead a normal, quiet life. Maggie feels heartsick. She had her suspicions that the article made Elodie's life sound too good to be true, compared to some of the other accounts she'd read. The article said you work as a seamstress, Clementine asks her, changing the subject. I used to, Elodie clarifies, biting her nails. When I first got out of the hospital, I'm a waitress now. Maggie suppresses disappointment, reminding herself she has no right to judge. She glances over at Gabriel and can tell by the pulsing vein in his forehead and the set to his mouth that he's holding back a deluge of emotion. Sewing sheets was the job I had at Saint-Nazarius, Elodie continues. It was pretty much all I knew how to do when I got out. But I'm much happier at the deli. Maggie shoots Gabriel a look, but he doesn't meet her gaze. I have so many questions, Elodie says, turning to Maggie. Were you close to my mother? Did you know about me? Yes, I knew about you, Maggie answers uncomfortably. What was she like? She was very young.
Her parents made her give you up, Gabriel adds.
They thought you'd be adopted right away, Maggie says. Everyone did. But that was before they converted the orphanages. That part of the article was true, Elodie says. Change of vocation day was the day my life may as well have ended. They all fall silent. Maggie has to squeeze back tears. They told us we were crazy, Elodie tells them. And that was it. From then on we were. What made you go to the newspaper with your story? It was my friend Marie-Claude's idea. She thought it would help me with my anger. She laughs out loud then, not a happy laugh. Instead, that stupid article made me angrier. She takes a cigarette out of her purse. You mind? Of course not. She lights up and inhales deeply. Marie-Claude meant well, she says, waving a cloud of smoke away from her face. And it turned out all right in the end because you found me. The whole time she's talking, Maggie can think of nothing other than how she's going to broach the truth with her.
Do you have a boyfriend? Gabriel asks her,
probably hoping that the care and protection of a good man might somehow redeem her tragic life. A man would think that way, Maggie reasons. It would make him feel better. No, I have a daughter, though, Elodie says, matter-of-factly. Her name is Nancy. A daughter? She's 3. The the same age as Stephanie. Maggie is numb. 3 years of my granddaughter's life missed, she thinks with a stab of grief.
Her father was going off to Vietnam when we met, Elodie explains. He doesn't even know about Nancy. I'm not sure he's even alive.
Did you try to find him?
No, I don't know his last name.
Maggie observes Gabrielle's jaw tightening and says, Do you have a picture of her?
No, she's very pretty and confident. She's nothing like me at all.
I'm sure she's very much like you, Maggie says, finding her voice. Elodie looks down at the floor, her knee bouncing nervously.
Who takes care of her when you're working? Clementine asks.
My neighbor.
And you earn enough to support the both of you? Maggie prods, unable to stop herself.
We manage, Elodie responds. I'm on welfare, which helps.
Maggie nods, not knowing what to say. She doesn't dare look in Gabrielle's direction or she might burst into tears.
I'm so grateful you found me, Elodie says. I didn't want Nancy to grow up without any family like I did. I hoped she might wind up with some cousins or something, a nice aunt or uncle.
She looks directly at Maggie.
Do you have any children?
Yes, Maggie responds. A boy and a girl.
Wow, I have cousins.
Maggie doesn't say anything.
So how old was my mother when she had me?
Elodie asks her.
16. Were you close? You didn't say.
Yes.
Did you know my father?
Elodie pursues.
No,
Maggie answers, not daring to glance in Gabrielle's direction.
Do you know anything else about your parents?
He asks Elodie.
Just that my mother is dead, she says.
Who told you that?
Sister Ignacia. She was in charge of our ward. She showed me my file and told me my mother died of her sins.
Maggie's heart clenches. She bites down on her lower lip to stay silent.
When did she tell you that?
Gabrielle asks her, impressively controlling his temper.
When I was 11, Elodie says. Right after the doctor interviewed me. That was when they started sending a lot of the orphans into foster care. Turns out we weren't crazy after all.
Gabrielle has guzzled his beer. His fingers on the can are trembling. I had to stay at San Azarius because my mother was dead and nobody wanted a teenage girl, Elodie adds, her tone flat.
Will you excuse me?
Maggie says, standing abruptly.
I'll be right back.
Upstairs in her bedroom, she sits down on the bed. Gabrielle joins her a few minutes later.
If what Elodie remembers is true, she says before he's even through the door, then Sister Ignacia must have told her I was dead right after we showed up at San Azarius, looking for her.
Gabrielle shakes his head helplessly.
She told me that Elodie was dead, Maggie goes on. And then she told Elodie that I was dead, just to keep us apart. Why would she do that? Why?
I'm going to throw a Molotov cocktail into that fucking hospital ward,
he says, sitting down beside her.
I don't know what to do, Gabe.
We're going to go downstairs and tell her we're her parents.
I'm too scared.
Of what?
That she'll hate me. Look at her, Gabe. She's... Did you notice her eyes? I've never seen so much sadness in someone so young. That article in the journal was all lies.
She's had a hard life, Maggie. We always knew that. But she's strong. She's a fighter, like her mother.
I can't even imagine what she's been through. I don't want to. She has a limp, you know, and that scar over her eye. It's my fault.
What happened to her in that place is not your fault.
The fact that she was ever there is my fault, she argues. And you know it, and I'm sure some part of you hates me for it, too.
Gabrielle sighs, lights a cigarette.
We've had this conversation, Maggie. I made my peace with your choice a long time ago.
She's suffered, and it can't ever be undone. This is who she is now.
You don't know who she is. You don't know anything about her yet.
I'm afraid to know, Maggie says childishly.
I'm going to get her, he says, standing up. It's time.
Maggie doesn't respond, but she doesn't stop him from leaving. Moments later, there's a soft knock on the doorframe, and Elodie steps into the room with obvious trepidation.
Is something the matter?
She asks, her voice small and scared.
Come in,
Maggie says, forcing a light voice. Elodie approaches. Here, Maggie says, sliding over. Sit. Elodie blinks nervously, hesitating. She doesn't trust Maggie. Probably doesn't trust, period. Maggie stares at her for several long seconds without speaking. She would give anything to just take her in her arms and hold her. I know this is an important day for you, she begins. Meeting your aunt. Not as important as if I was meeting my mother. Maggie shifts nervously on the bed and looks down at the floor. I have something to tell you, she says, her voice wavering. You are meeting your mother.
Eh? What do you mean?
Elodie cries.
That other lady, Clementine, is she my mother?
I'm your mother, Elodie. Elodie doesn't move. Her eyes register passing clouds of shock, disbelief, incredulity. They sit for a long time in silence, tears sliding down both their cheeks.
I don't believe you,
Elodie says finally.
You can't be.
I'm your mother, Maggie states, more firmly this time. You were born March 6th, 1950. It was a Sunday night.
It's not possible. My mother died.
That's what the nun told you, Maggie explains gently. But it wasn't true. A strange noise comes out of Elodie, guttural from deep inside, a tortured sound that breaks Maggie's heart.
That nun told me the same thing, Maggie says. That you were dead. Sister Ignacia, when?
Maggie reaches for her daughter's hand. It flops limply in her own.
Elodie, she says. First, can I just hold you in my arms?
Elodie nods, tears rolling down her face, and they collapse into each other. Maggie's body surrenders wholly to the embrace, heart surging, muscles unclenching, limbs loosening with indescribable relief. There's an instant release of tension, deliverance from a lifetime of chronic worry that's become as natural and constant as breathing. Not since the day she gave birth to this child has she ever felt whole or fully at peace.
You don't know how long I've waited for this moment,
Elodie sobs, her voice muffled against Maggie's neck.
Yes, Maggie says, releasing her. I do. Not a day has gone by in 24 years that I haven't thought about you, my daughter. When did Sister Ignacia tell you I was dead?
We went to San Azarius in 61 to find you, Maggie tells her. I'd been looking for you for a long time. First, I went to the orphanage.
Saint-Sulpice?
Yes, but it was a hospital by then.
Did you speak to Sister Alberta?
Elodie asks her, her eyes filling with fresh tears.
She was kind to me. I loved her. I remember the nuns used to call it the home for unwanted girls, but it wasn't a bad place before it became a mental hospital.
Maggie struggles to hold back the anger that's stuck in her throat. That word again, unwanted, like she was some discarded doll.
Was she there? Elodie asks. Sister Tata?
I spoke to the caretaker, Maggie says. He suggested I write to the government for information, which I did. I finally got hold of a document showing that two groups of orphans had been transferred to Mercy and San Azarius in 57. Gabrielle and I went to both.
And she told you I was dead.
Maggie nods. Elodie reaches for the pack of cigarettes in her front pocket and lights one, fingers trembling.
She was a monster, that woman. But to tell us both the other was dead, when she could have let you take me home.
I can't comprehend that kind of cruelty either, Maggie murmurs.
There aren't words.
The pain has a suffocating quality, the kind that leaves you gasping for breath. Maggie suddenly remembers that scratchy wool blanket at Dida and Yvonne's house, the way it felt on her body when she was being raped. Like she was being smothered and couldn't breathe.
I know this is a lot to take in, she says. You must have a million questions for me. Why did you give me up?
Elodie asks, her voice cutting through their shared grief. The air goes out of the room. Here it is, Maggie thinks. I was 15 when I got pregnant, she says, looking directly into their daughter's desolate blue eyes. I wasn't allowed to keep you. It's not a very original story, but it's the truth. My father made arrangements to... She almost blurts out sell you, but corrects herself in time. To have you adopted by a couple who couldn't have children of their own. But there were some complications when you were born, and the couple changed their minds. You were sent to Saint-Sulpice when you were well enough. Elodie stubs out her cigarette in the ashtray next to her bed. She sniffles and wipes her nose. How hard this must be for her to hear. Even harder than it is for Maggie to say. I named you Elodie, Maggie continues. It's a type of lily. It's very hardy. Her voice trails off. Elodie is watching her, waiting for something else. I started trying to find you after my third miscarriage, Maggie says. It was 1959. I blamed myself for the miscarriages. I thought God was punishing me for having given you away. I never stopped thinking about you. I never felt whole, ever. She dabs her eyes with her shirt sleeve. I know how much you've suffered, but no, Elodie says. You don't? Maggie bites her lip. Who is my father? Maggie takes a long, nervous breath. It's Gabriel, she says, trying to keep her voice and gaze steady. Elodie's back straightens. Him, she says, pointing to the door. Your husband? Yes. You married him? Yes, but why couldn't you have kept me then? She asks, obviously wounded. If you were together and you loved each other. It was complicated, Maggie attempts, persevering in the face of her daughter's shock. My parents sent me away to live with my aunt and uncle in another town, so I couldn't be with Gabriel. Why? My father wanted someone else for me, she says. Someone educated from a better family. I found out I was pregnant while I was living with my aunt and uncle, so I had to stay there until you were born. Did Gabriel know you were pregnant? I didn't tell him, Maggie confesses. Couldn't you have married him? The way Elodie puts it makes it sound so simple, so logical. Perhaps it should have been. I didn't think I had a choice, Maggie explains sheepishly. I was only 15. Elodie considers this, but the hurt and bewilderment on her face is rebuke enough. They told me I couldn't keep you, and that was the way it was, Maggie says. It was 1950. I couldn't go against them. Elodie remains silent. I broke it off with Gabrielle that summer, Maggie continues. He moved to Montreal, and that was the last I heard from him. We both ended up marrying other people. How did you find each other? And when? Our families were neighbors, Maggie explains. We reconnected about 10 years later. We rekindled a friendship and then, well, things got quite messy for a while, but eventually we both got divorced from our spouses and started a life together. So your children are my brother and sister? Yes, Maggie says almost guiltily. James and Stephanie. Mon Dieu. I know this is a lot to absorb, Maggie says, reaching for her daughter's hands again. If only I could convince you how guilty I've felt every single day of my life since I gave you up. I wish I'd kept you and stayed with Gabrielle, and that we would have been together all along. I wish I hadn't been so afraid, but I was. I was so terrified. I understand, Elodie says, but her voice is small. I hope you can, Maggie whispers, her voice breaking. They sob together for a little while, Elodie's hands locked inside Maggie's. Do I look like them? Elodie asks, wiping her eyes. Your kids? I think there's a resemblance, Maggie says. Would you like to meet them? I wasn't sure. Of course, Elodie interrupts. All my life I've longed for a big family. Sisters and brothers, grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins. Of course I want to meet them. Maggie pulls Elodie into her arms and clings to her. Elodie lets Maggie hold her like that for a long time, until Maggie finally pulls away and stares into her daughter's haunted eyes. She strokes her long blonde hair and cups the girl's chin in the palm of her hand. You're so beautiful, she whispers. No, I'm not, Elodie says. But you are. I never imagined you with black hair. Maggie stands up and pulls Elodie to her feet. She leads her across the room to the mirror above the dresser, and they stand side by side, staring at their reflections. There's definitely a family resemblance, Maggie says. Not our coloring, but look here. She points out their eyebrows and noses, and the shape of our eyes is exactly the same. Maybe, Elodie concedes, clearly unconvinced. You look a bit like my sisters, too, Maggie says. I have three of them, and a brother. You wanted a big family, that's what you're getting. Elodie hasn't taken her eyes away from the mirror, as though she can't quite believe what she's seeing. Is it really you? She asks. I'm afraid if I look away, you'll be gone. I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere, Maggie reassures her. Elodie reaches out and touches the mirror. I know this is a lot to ask, Maggie says, still looking straight ahead into the mirror. But do you think you can ever forgive me? Elodie hesitates before responding, taking her time to think about it. The silence is interminable. Finally, she says, You are young. What else could I do? No one knows better than me that it's a sin to have a baby out of wedlock. That's more than I could have hoped for, Maggie says. Thank you. Elodie leans her head on Maggie's shoulder. Maggie doesn't budge. She barely breathes. She wants to stay exactly like this as long as possible. Maman, Elodie says, and Maggie understands that she's just saying the word out loud to test it, that no response is required. Maman. I see your father in your face too, Maggie says softly. And then, after a few more minutes in the mirror, should we go back? They leave the bedroom and go downstairs. Elodie approaches the chair where Gabrielle is waiting for them. Allô, papa, she says. Long after everyone has gone to sleep, Maggie climbs out of bed and creeps down the hall. She stops at James's room to peek in on him, and she can see by the blue and green light of his lava lamp that his legs are dangling off the bed, his body rising and falling beneath his quilt. In the next room, she finds Stephanie sleeping horizontally across her bed, with her Raggedy Ann doll on the floor. Maggie picks it up, tucks it under Stephanie's arm, and kisses the little girl's warm cheek. Finally, Maggie reaches the end of the hall and stops outside the guest bedroom, where her other daughter, her firstborn, is spending the night. She stands there for a moment, overcome with emotion. Never would she have imagined all her children sleeping under one roof. She opens the door as quietly as possible and freezes when she hears the soft sobbing from inside. She considers going in to comfort Elodie, but quickly dismisses the idea. Elodie might prefer to be alone. She's always been alone after all. A stranger barging in on her in the middle of the night might make her uncomfortable. And Maggie is a stranger, mother or not. She has to remind herself of that. She has to remember to go slow. And so Maggie backs away and heads downstairs to the kitchen. She pours herself a glass of wine, lights one of Gabrielle's cigarettes, and sits down at the table. Her mind is wired. A welcome numbness has washed over her, subduing some of the intensity of the day's events. But she can't shut down her thoughts. What have I let happen to her? The question beats like a drum in her head. Elodie is upstairs crying into her pillow. How many tears has she already shed in her lifetime? How many nights has she cried herself to sleep? How deep are her wounds? How bereaved is her soul? And all Maggie can do is sit here helplessly, knowing she is the cause of it. Her worst fear is that all the love in the world, which Maggie and Gabrielle are prepared to give, can't possibly be enough to neutralize what's been done to Elodie, or restore what's been destroyed. Maggie gets up and grabs the bottle of wine from the fridge. May as well finish it. It's the only one left over from dinner. They all drank too much, part celebration, part tension reliever. She fills her glass and notices the box of her father's things sitting on the floor by the pantry. She hauled it out the other day in anticipation of Elodie's visit. She goes to it now and settles on the floor with her wine and her ashtray, and starts making neat piles of the contents. Old agriculture books, business and inspirational books, cards and drawings his children gave him over the years. Someday she will tell Elodie about her grandfather, maybe even take her to the seed store, where he was larger than life. She would like Elodie to know that he was so much more than just the person who took her away from her mother, that he was fundamentally a good man, trying to protect his own daughter. Over and over again, he attempted to redeem what he'd done, always with quiet, meaningful gestures that ultimately yielded fruit. First, he sent Elodie into the world with her name, a seemingly small detail but momentous enough to have made their reunion possible. Then he'd tried to get her back from the orphanage, and finally he conceived of the ad that brought them back together. There's really a perfect symmetry to it all, Maggie thinks, a sweet, symbiotic full circle that's led them to this moment. Her mother used to say, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Maggie is reminded of that now. Her father took away, and then he gave. Your grandfather was known as the Seed Man. In spite of everything, Maggie has managed to turn out all right. She is a mother of three children, all of them here tonight in the house she loves so much. She is a wife, a lover of seeds and language, a French woman with English blood, an English woman with French blood. She is neither fully one thing nor another, as she's always wanted to be. She is arrogant and humble, audacious and timid, alive. She is still growing and always will be. She pulls Elodie's baby blanket and hospital bracelet out of the box, and then retrieves an elastic-bound stack of photographs. She lingers over them for a while, lost in bittersweet nostalgia, until she finds herself staring at a picture of her father, standing in the middle of a garden she doesn't recognize. He's knee-deep in flowers, with a wooden rail fence behind him. He's in his late 30s, wearing suspenders and a white Panama hat that conceals his premature baldness. He has a round face, a curly mustache, and he's holding a cigar between his fingers. He looks content, as though there's nowhere else on earth he'd rather be but in that garden, communing with nature in all its wild splendor. It's an expression Maggie recognizes from when she used to observe him working at the seed store, fully and wholly in his element. A place Maggie has found herself in many times over the last few years, and where she knows she will be again. Chapter 56. Elodie. Elodie hears the door open and holds her breath. She knows it's her mother. Her mother. Over and over again she's been repeating that word in her head. No longer some hypothetical idea or childhood delusion. Her mother is here to hold her in the dark, to wipe away her tears and take away her pain and terrors.
Maggie,
she whispers, but her voice is too meek, not quite loud enough. And as suddenly as the door opens, it closes, and Elodie can hear Maggie retreating down the stairs. Her heart sinks. Maggie must have heard Elodie crying and fled. Elodie lies very still. She hadn't realized how much she'd been longing for her mother to comfort her. Even in a house full of people, in this pretty room with its floral wallpaper and grand brass bed and red patchwork quilt, she still feels frightened and strangely hollow. Resentment starts to bubble up inside her, and she reminds herself that for all their kind words and hospitality, she is probably just a nuisance to them. She wonders what it would have been like to grow up in this lovely, warm house full of love. That girl in there, Stephanie, her sister, the same age as Nancy, with her fat pink cheeks and her fearlessness and her happy disposition, will grow up with everything that was taken away from Elodie. It should have been me, she thinks with a stab of acrimony. I came first. She lies there stewing for what feels like a very long time. She can hear the crickets outside, and it reminds her of her early years at Saint-Sulpice, a memory she'd forgotten until now. She used to love them chirping outside her window. There were no other sounds to drown them out, only the perfect silence of a country night. Sister Tata told her the chirping noise came from the males rubbing their wings together. How could she have ever forgotten that? She doesn't fall asleep. How could she? All she wants is to go home to Nancy. She misses Nancy's warm little body curled up against her, her sweet breath against her skin. And then the door opens again, and this time Maggie enters the room. The floor creaks as she approaches the bed, her weight on the edge of the mattress, her hand on Elodie's damp cheek. Elodie, she whispers, do you want to be alone?
No,
Elodie blurts, her voice childlike. Good, Maggie says. I'm here. Elodie reaches for her.
Don't go,
she says, and as she listens to Maggie's heartbeat, she feels the bitterness fade.
Of course not, Maggie promises. I wasn't sure you wanted me. I've always wanted you.
Maggie settles in beside her and rests her head against a propped-up pillow.
Will you write my story? Elodie asks her. Will you tell it exactly the way it happened?
Yes, Maggie answers without having to give it any thought. Of course I will.
And will it be published?
Absolutely, she says, knowing it will. She will fight for that. Godbout will help her if need be. The idea feels as right as anything she's ever set her mind to.
We have to do it soon, Elodie says. I want it to be published while Sister Ignacia is still at San Nazarius. And I want you to use her real name, and for us to bring it to her in person.
Yes, Maggie agrees, her heart racing with excitement. The prospect of a new project that will require them to work together for many months, their lives intertwined, their connection deepening, while at the same time outing Elodie's abuser, is exhilarating.
Thank you, Elodie says. I'll give you my notebook to start. I've written absolutely everything in it.
Maybe you could live here with us while we work on it, Maggie suggests. I don't want to pressure you, but Stephanie and Nancy are about the same age.
Elodie can't quite believe the offer. Nancy would love it here in the country, she says. It must be a beautiful place to grow up.
And you could be home with her, Maggie says. At least until she starts school, and then there would always be a job for you at my store.
It sounds nice, Elodie says, thinking about her apartment in Pointe-Saint-Charles, and Len's Deli, how much she would miss working there.
I don't want to overwhelm you, Maggie adds. We have all the time in the world for you to decide. She puts her arms around Elodie and strokes her hair. They lie like that for a long time, wide awake in the dark.
I'll never sleep tonight, Elodie says.
When I was little, my father used to recite this poem to help me fall asleep, Maggie whispers softly.
Tell it to me, Elodie says. Let me see if I can remember it.
Johnny Appleseed, Johnny Appleseed, she begins, using the French translation, Jean Pépin de Pomme. In that pack on his back, in that talisman sack, tomorrow's peaches, pears, and cherries, tomorrow's grapes and red raspberries, seeds and tree souls, precious things, feathered with microscopic wings. Elodie closes her eyes. Maybe I've died, she thinks. The feelings inside her are too good, unfamiliar. There's sadness too, of course. This she accepts as the most natural, inevitable aspect of her life. Sadness lives in her cells, alongside her sense of injustice and outrage toward Sister Ignatia and God. These things cannot be transcended. They are as much a part of her being as her limbs and her organs and Nancy. But tonight there's something else. Hope. She has a family now, at the helm of which is a beautiful, living, breathing mother. A mother who wants to be in her life, who tried to find her more than once, and wants forgiveness and a second chance. A mother who was forced to give her up and then tried to get her back. Elodie can live with that. She will never get those 24 years back. She knows she will carry the burden of her past for as long as she is alive. But at least now she has a future as part of a family. All the outdoors the child heart knows, and the apple green, red, and white, Maggie continues. Son of his day and his night, the apple allied to the thorn, child of the rose. Elodie doesn't understand the poem. She doesn't need to. Nothing is diminished by the not knowing.
This is Saskia Marleveld. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Home for Unwanted Girls, a novel by Joanna Goodman. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 2018 by Joanna Goodman. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.